introducing the introducer tonight, and that would be wonderful writer and professor Ethel Morgenstern.
Valerie Boyd is the author of Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. It was the first biography of Zora Neale Hurston in 25 years, held by Alice Walker as magnificent and extraordinary. The Washington Post, definitive. The Boston Globe, elegant and exhilarating. The Denver Post, rich, rich read. For Wrapped in a Rainbow, Valerie received the Georgia Author of the Year Award in Nonfiction, as well as the American Literary Association Notable Book Award. The Georgia Center for Books proclaimed Wrapped in a Rainbow one of the 25 books all Georgians should read, and the Southern Critics Circle honored it with its 2003 Southern Book Award for Best Nonfiction of that year. Valerie is the Associate Professor in Journalism and the Charlene Hunter Gall Distinguished Writer in Residence at the University of Georgia, where she teaches narrative nonfiction writer as well as art and literary journalism. So I need to mention a little bit about Charlene Hunter Gall since we're doing Women's History Month. In 1961, Athens, Georgia witnessed part of the Civil Rights Movement when Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes became the first two African-American students to enroll in the University of Georgia. She graduated in 1963. So it's quite a privilege that you share that name of that, and she was the first woman, first black woman to graduate from that school. Valerie is also an accomplished journalist and cultural critic. She's the former arts editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she has published in numerous anthologies, magazines, and newspapers. Her articles, essays, and reviews have appeared in Step Into a World, a global anthology of the New Black Literature, Ms. Magazine, Pace, the Oxford American Book Magazine, Essence, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, Creative Nonfiction, African American Review, and other publications. Valerie is currently working to finish her next book, which is Spirits in the Dark, the Untold Story of Black Women in Hollywood. And she recently began working with Alice Walker to edit a collection of the acclaimed writer's journals. Let us welcome Valerie Boyd. Thank you.
Good evening. How's everybody? I wanted to first thank Ethel and Mark for inviting me to participate. And I wanted to thank you all, echoing Mark, for braving the weather and coming out to hear a reader read. That's pretty impressive that you braved the snow to hear a reader read. So yay to you, thank you. So I would like to just read a little bit from Wrapped in Rainbows, my biography of Zora Neale Hurston. And then I'd like to just open it up for questions and dialogue. How many of you have read Zora Neale Hurston's most famous book, Their Eyes Were Watching God? Okay, so a few of you. Okay, so what you need to know about Zora Neale Hurston is that she was the most published, most famous, and most significant black woman writer of the first half of the 20th century. She published 7 books in her lifetime. And all of these books were written and published between 1934 and 1948. So a black woman publishing 7 books in the 1930s and 40s was pretty remarkable. You know, she was the ancestor and precursor to writers that we know today, like Alice Walker or Toni Morrison or Pearl Clegg or any of the writers, any of the black women writers that you might have read. Everyone, you know, pays homage to Zora Neale Hurston as a literary foremother. And so, you know, that just gives you a sense of who she is. Her most famous book was a novel called Their Eyes Were Watching God. It was published in 1937. And it's the story of a woman named Janie who is on a journey to know herself. The novel begins when Janie is 16 years old and it follows her up until her early 40s. And we see Janie go through 3 relationships with men that sort of define her growth over the years. And it's an incredible novel because it's exploring the inner life of a self-educated rural black woman. And in the 1930s, when it was published, that was really revolutionary. Nobody really thought black women's lives were that interesting or that worthy of literature. And so Zora Neale Hurston really kind of blazed new trails by saying, you know, ordinary people, ordinary, you know, rural country folk, and black people, nonetheless, you know, sharecroppers, you know, migrant workers, these people's lives are worthy of literature. And so that's why she's such an important writer. And Their Eyes Were Watching God was turned into a TV movie starring Halle Berry. So if you, you know, want to get a modern take on it, you can take a look at the movie. But I think the book is better. So if you watch the movie, read the book after, and you'll see what I mean. So what I would like to do is read a section from my biography of Zora Neale Hurston that talks about where Their Eyes Were Watching God came from. It's a book that I discovered in my research on Hurston, grew out of her own life, and it grew out of a relationship that she had with a younger man. The pivotal character, one of the pivotal male characters in her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, is a man named Tea Cake, and he's a younger man who Janie has a relationship with, and it really kind of opens her life in ways that she hadn't anticipated at, you know, at the point when she has a relationship with him in her 40s. So I discovered that Zora Neale Hurston had a relationship with a younger man, her own Tea Cake, that really inspired the novel. And so I want to read that section of my book. And then, as I said, I'd be happy to take questions and we can just have a conversation. So I'm actually going to read from my... A graduate student at Columbia University, his name was Percival McGuire Hunter. Zora had met him 4 years before when he was an undergraduate at the City College of New York. A member of his college orchestra, Hunter had enough musical talent to land a singing part in the original production of The Great Day, a folk concert that Zora Neale Hurston wrote and directed, and that was performed at the John Golden Theater in January 1932. Zora had noticed Hunter then. He was tall, dark brown, magnificently built, as she recalled, with a beautifully modeled back head. His profile was strong and good, she observed, but his looks only drew my eyes in the beginning. I did not fall in love with him just for that. He had a fine mind, and that intrigued me. When a man keeps beating me to the draw mentally, he begins to get glamorous. Still, Zora, so recently divorced from Herbert Sheen, did not express her interest in Hunter at the time. When they met again in 1935, though, their mutual attraction soon became obvious. He began to make shy overtures to me, Zora would remember. I pretended not to notice for a while, so that I could be sure and not be hurt. Then he gave me the extreme pleasure of telling me right out loud about it. It seems that he had been in love with me just as long as I had been with him, but he was afraid that I didn't mean him any good, as the saying goes. The reasons for Punter's initial reticence toward Hurston are fairly obvious. With her gingerbread-colored skin, her intrepid eyes sparkling like polished pennies, and her one-of-a-kind wardrobe, Zora had a funky elegance that many men found attractive. Beyond her sex appeal, Hurston also had a certain amount of notoriety that Punter at first may have found intimidating. She'd been the subject of feature articles in the New York Press. She'd been toasted on Park Avenue, and she'd traveled the country. Punter, on the other hand, was just a poor graduate student whose father was a maintenance man in a big building downtown. Punter had no money, Zora knew, and nothing to offer but what it takes, as she put it, a bright soul, a fine mind, and a fine body, and courage. Another inhibiting factor for Punter and for Hurston may have been the age difference between them. Born in 1912, Punter was barely 23 years old in 1935. Zora was 44. Hunter surely knew his love interest was older than him, but because of Zora's persistent mendacity about her age, he probably had no idea that she was more than 20 years his senior. Zora knew, though. And despite her clear ability to maintain what she called her mental youth, she must have questioned the long-haul wisdom of getting involved with a man so much younger than herself. She did not question it for long, however. Punter's forthright gaze, refulgent smile, and licorice skin, not to mention his fine mind, became too tempting for Zora to resist. People waste too much time worrying about whether an affair will last, she rationalized. Enjoy it while it does last, and then suffer no regrets later. In no time, Hurston and Punter were immersed in an intensely passionate, mutually satisfying romance. It was, Zora will recall, the real love affair of my life. Before Punter, Zora's courtships had been rather casual. Valuing her freedom above all else, she could find passion in a given moment, but those moments tended to pass fairly quickly. With Punter, however, the moment appeared to be never-ending, and Zora began to make room in her life for a committed relationship. She enjoyed cooking for her sweetheart when she could. Her cool, crystallized grapefruit peel was a particular favorite as warmer temperatures began to descend on the city. The lovers stayed up late talking about religion, art, and literature. Punter was impressed by Zora's instinct for art. She intuitively knew what was good and lasting, he observed, and she seemed to quietly recognize the enduring value of her own work. To keep up with her writing, Zora sometimes got up in the middle of the night to write. Even this adjustment did not curb the couple's passion. Punter called his beloved Skookums because she reminded him of the Indian on the Skookum apples label. And every day, Zora found new angles for her adoration. No matter which way I probed him, she allowed, I found something more to admire. We fitted each other like a glove. Zora emerged from the love nest on the afternoon of Friday, May 10th, to attend a tea in her honor at the Women's University Club on East 52nd Street. Annie Nathan Meyer, who sponsored Zora's education at Barnard, helped to plan the tea. Celebs too numerous to mention were there, Zora boasted. Among them, publisher Bertram Lippincott, who traveled from Philadelphia for the occasion, and novelist Robert Nathan, Pearl S. Buck, and Fanny Hurst, who said a few congratulating words. Zora wore a flaming white dress, a terrific looking kind of thing, as Lippincott recalled, and all kind of big wraps all around her like a movie actress. Punter did not attend the tea with Hurst. Her increasing celebrity and the apparent delight she took in it was beginning to rattle him. Perhaps because of the age difference and because of Zora's worldliness, Punter was starting to wonder how long he could hold her attention. I was hogtied and branded, she admitted, but he didn't realize it. He could make me fetch and carry, but he wouldn't believe it. So when Zora attended literary parties or met people on business, Punter often sulked, and then Zora became unhappy too. One evening, for instance, the two were at Zora's apartment, soaked in ecstasy, when her telephone rang. A literary celebrity was in town and wanted to meet her. Zora was eager to go, but Punter asked her not to. She invited him to join her. He refused and walked out. Zora went to the gathering, as she recalled, but she was distracted and downcast all evening. Another time, looking at the very serious Carl Van Vechten photo of Zora in which she looked mean and impressive, Punter said he wanted her to look that way all the time, unless she was with him. Zora almost laughed out loud, not because she found the statement absurd, but because she felt the same way about Percy, as she called him. He was so extraordinary that I lived in terrible fear lest women camp on his doorstep in droves and take him away from me, she confessed. I hated to think of him smiling, unless he was smiling at me. Eventually, Punter asked Zora to give up her career, marry him, and leave New York. The marrying and leaving New York parts were fine. Zora preferred to write in Florida anyway. New York is not a good place to think in, she once complained. I could do hack work here, but I need quiet to really work. The idea of giving up her career, however, was chilling. I really wanted to do anything he wanted me to do, she would recall, but that one thing I could not do. Punter did not seem to understand that Hurston's work was her sustenance. I'm tired of seeing you work so hard, he told her. I wouldn't want my wife to do anything but look after me. be home looking like Skookums when I got there. But Zora needed to do more with her life than look after a man, no matter how wonderful he might be. I had things clawing inside of me that must be said, she tried to explain. I could not see that my work should make any difference in marriage. He was all and everything else to me but that. One did not conflict with the other in my mind, but it was different with him. He felt that he did not matter to me enough. He was the master kind, all or nothing for him. Hurston and Punter continued to see each other despite this fundamental conflict, and their mutual jealousies escalated. If Punter smiled too broadly at a woman on 7th Avenue, Zora fumed. If she accepted a kiss on the cheek from a male acquaintance, Punter smoldered. Their love became blissful misery. We were alternately the happiest people in the world, Zora recognized, and the most miserable. One night, an argument turned particularly ugly, Hurston recalled. Something primitive inside me tore past the barriers, and before I realized it, I had slapped his face. This was a mistake. Angry over some week-old hurt, Punter struck back. To Zora's horror, she and Punter were soon trading slaps and shoves. No broken bones, you understand, and no black eyes, but combat nonetheless. Stunned by the wrong turn their passion had taken, the two ended up on the floor together, apologizing to each other profusely. He went out and bought a pie while she made a pot of hot chocolate, over which they made up fervently. The next day, he built her a bookcase, and the couple became more affectionate than ever. But something had changed for Zora. Then I knew I was too deeply in love to be my old self, she admitted. For always, a blow to my body had infuriated me beyond measure. Even with my parents, that was true. But somehow, I didn't hate him at all. Delirious with joy and pain, Zora had lost hold of herself, and this frightened her. I suddenly decided to go away and see if I could live without him. I did not even tell him that I was going, but I wired him from some town in Virginia. After a few months of research in Georgia and Florida with New York University professor Mary Elizabeth Barnacle and young collector Alan Lomax, Zora returned to New York and back to Percy Punter's arms, just as much his slave as ever, as she put it. To her dismay, the same old jealousy soon resurfaced, and she and Punter again were locked in a vise of divine nights and devilish days. Our bitterest enemies could not have contrived more exquisite torture for us, she commented. On March 16, 1936, the Guggenheim Foundation informed Hurston that she had been awarded a $2,000 grant for a study of magic practices among Negroes in the West Indies. The fellowship would last for 12 months, beginning immediately. Hurston told Guggenheim officials she would be ready to board a steamer to Jamaica anytime after April 1st. She turned in her health certificate and settled her business affairs in New York. Personal affairs did not wrap up so easily, however. Although Percy Punter still wanted to marry Zora, her career continued to balk the completeness of his ideal, as she phrased it. To me, there was no conflict. My work was one thing, and he was all of the rest, but I could not make him see that. Nothing must be in my life but himself. Given this ongoing and elemental conflict, Zora had quietly concluded that marrying Punter was not an option. When she said goodbye to him and headed off to the Caribbean for a year of study, though, she claimed to be acting in his best interests. As soon as he took his second degree, he was in line for bigger and better jobs, she observed, but he seemed rather disinterested in his own career. I began to feel that our love was slowing down his efforts. I grew terribly afraid that later on he would feel that I had thwarted him in a way and come to resent me. That was a scorching thought. Even if I married him, what about 5 years from now, the way we were going? Hurston also knew, but never said, that in 5 years, she would be almost 50 years old, while Punter would still be under 30. This knowledge, quiet as she kept it, surely impacted her decision as well. The Guggenheim Fellowship, as Hurston saw it, was my chance to release him and fight myself free from my obsession. He would get over me in a few months and go on to be a very big man. With this justification, Zora said a hasty farewell to her beloved and sailed off to the Caribbean. But I freely admit that everywhere I set my feet down, she said, there were tracks of blood, blood from the very middle of my heart. I did not write because if I had written and he answered my letter, everything would have broken down. Punter told a different story. Hurston was possessed of an almost priestly devotion to her work, he believed, and she fully understood what her career demanded. Her work was her master, and she followed his commands obediently, as would any faithful disciple. As a mere man, Punter simply could not compete. Zora may have cried on the inside when she left him, he said, but he never saw any tears. On Monday, April 13th, Hurston touched land in Haiti, where she introduced herself to government officials and made plans for returning to the small island nation in September. From her Port-au-Prince pit stop, she mailed a postcard to a friend, seeming to confirm Hunter's perception that she had little trouble walking away from their love and turning her mind to other matters. On my way, Zora wrote, shall write you at length from Jamaica. Weather fine. Men plentiful. Despite this flippant statement, Hurston found Punter impossible to forget. In Jamaica, she threw herself into her research, partly to smother her feelings for Percy Punter and her remorse over the abrupt way she ended their relationship. But when she got to Haiti a few months later, she realized that her emotions had not been smothered at all. They'd simply been dammed up inside her, as she put it. On the shores of the celestial blue sea, Zora's flimsy emotional embankments gave way, releasing a flood of feelings that forced her to write, sometimes late at night after a strenuous day of research. Under internal pressure, commanded by a force from somewhere in space, as she put it, Zora started writing a novel, working urgently for days on end. All the while, her love for Punter stayed on her mind. The plot was far from the circumstances, she noted, but I tried to embalm all the tenderness of my passion for him in the novel. On December 19, 1936, after only 7 weeks, Hurston finished the book that would become known as her masterpiece. She called it, Their Eyes Were Watching God.